Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Podcast time. This one's a special one. MK. I don't really need to introduce him. One of the biggest artists in the world. I've known MK for a pretty long time. The first time I met him, he probably doesn't even remember the first time I met him, but he played my track Big Booty at Motion in Bristol. And I went up, and in fact, I think I messaged him beforehand, and we met there. We've done a lot of traveling together, written some music together. One of the nicest guys ever, and has some great stories. So, without further ado, MK, Mr. MK, what's cooking?
What's up, Willie?
How's it going?
I'm good, man. Just, you know, sunny California. You're in cold Detroit.
Snowy Detroit. You're about to get here, though.
Yeah. I know. I'm excited, though.
Yeah. How's life? You were in Big Bear last time I spoke to you.
Yeah, I was in Big Bear. And in the snow. Excuse me.
Not snowboarding.
I mean, I'm too clumsy. I'd break something.
Talking about clumsy. We're going to talk about London.
Oh. Yeah, talk about it. I'm still a little sore.
Are you still sore?
Yeah. I had those, for people that don't know, I had these Balenciaga like snow boots on. Not snow boots, I'm sorry, wellies.
Wellies.
They're wellies.
Yeah.
Actually they were croc wellies. Balenciaga croc wellies. So the inside, they're just huge on the inside.
Are they comfortable?
They're not as bad as you would think. They look like they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But they were fine. But my feet are so big. So when I walk down the stairs, I have to turn my feet sideways to walk down the stairs. And luckily I was on the last step at the bottom and I rolled my ankle and just like bit it like flat out. Oof. But luckily I had a few drinks that night. So it didn't bother me right away.
Until the day after.
Yeah. And then I looked at it. I'm like, whoa, one ankle was like this big. Went home, went to the doctor, got x-rays. They're like, it's not broken or anything.
Oh, that's handy.
It was still swollen for most of December. It's a little okay now. Still a little tender, but I'm all right. But yeah, I'm clumsy.
Oh, man. How's life been anyway? How's Christmas and all that? I haven't really caught up with you.
Christmas was good. I bought a house.
What?
I bought another house. Yeah, I bought another house not too far 5 minutes from my house. I'm going to move my studio there.
Sick.
And just get a proper, because you know, you, well, you see my studio in my house. It's in my guest house.
Yeah, yeah.
But I bought like a new house. I'm going to make like that the area 10, you know, four Crap. Bedroom studio. Yeah.
That'd be amazing. That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Are you going to do like live rooms and stuff, or are you just going to do, how are you going to do
No, I'm not going to do a live room. Just a vocal booth.
Yeah. Do you do many vocals in house, or do you, is it mostly like external?
I have. Yeah. I have. I think I've done a lot of Annabelle stuff here. Mm. Pleasure State stuff. Yeah. But I haven't in the past year or two.
Yeah.
But I've recorded Annabelle here. But I want to get into doing more vocals myself, because a lot of times, you know how it is lately. It's like you guys, we all have like vocals sent in.
Yeah.
Vocals go and record and send them in. And like, I've been having problems like really getting a good vocal that I like.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I'm this picky about vocals. So I'm going back to old school. I'm like, yo, just, you got to meet me in the studio.
I think it's, I think it's also like adds to the creative process, right? Is where you're not kind of like trying to write a record over a vocal. You're trying to like actually
make
grow the whole process from start to finish.
Exactly. And a lot of times, you know, when people write songs or try to give songs to me, they'll go listen to another song I have.
Yeah.
And try to make something similar. Mm. And like, it's like, that's kind of, it's kind of the wrong approach.
It's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because it's like, you don't want to put out another record the same sounding.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
You can do the MK thing to any vocal you want, really. So it's just, you just need to have a good record. Yeah. I also think nowadays as well, like the way dance music's so commercialized, which is a great thing for all of us because it means that we can get paid. But I think it means that music's a lot more throwaway. So you have a lot more people just trying to write hits rather than good songs.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because lately I've been getting either or. I'll get like a really good melody, but the lyrics are just like, I'm like, come on, really? You're going to say that? Like, or the opposite. I'll get like really good lyrics and just the melody's just not there. I'm like, it's trying to find the two.
It's kind of hard when you're in, when you're doing stuff remotely as well, or you're just getting sent stuff to like go back into the sessions and kind of go back to writing with somebody. It's kind of, it's just long, really.
Yeah.
And probably by that time that you get somebody in the studio, somebody else has the record and they've done something with it. So it's kind of just
The last time I went in the studio was, I was in London not too long ago with Aluna George.
Oh, really? She's amazing.
Went in the studio with her, and it's like, her lyrics are freaking dope, and her melodies are dope.
Yeah.
So she's the one that has it, like, she has it locked in. She definitely has it locked
in. What was the Disclosure record she did, You and Me?
White Noise?
White Noise, dude, that record. Yeah. I've been listening to that album quite a lot recently, and Jesus Christ, it was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I love those guys.
Yeah, special.
They're definitely my top five.
Yeah?
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure.
Did you check out the new one of Zed?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I played a couple times, my sets.
Yeah, it reminded me of like old Disclosure. I was like, this is, it sounds terrible coming from us to say this, but it's like, it's exactly what I wanted from them.
Yeah, I know. But I hear that a lot.
I think that's just being a
fan. That's what I wanted. Yeah.
Just give me the piano. That's all I want.
Yeah, I know. I hate that.
I guess the thing is there's a blessing and a curse with having your own sound, right?
But the bad part is the only reason I use piano is because I initially, when I work on songs, when someone sends me vocals, I start with piano.
Yeah.
Because it's easiest to hear all the melodies without hearing like some crazy synth sound that kind of blurries what's really going on.
Yeah.
So piano, I can hear the exact melodies. And I end up like laying chords, and then I'm like, I can't find anything that sounds better than that then.
Yeah.
At that point. So I keep getting stuck. So I need to figure something else out. Different format. I don't know. Whatever.
I wanna talk about your history more so.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of people nowadays know you as who you are now, but there's so much more that a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, for sure.
I had Stacey Pullen in the studio the other day, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. he kind of mentioned you when you were in Detroit.
Right.
And I kind of want to go back to then and go through all of it. I think it would be a really interesting kind of history lesson for everybody, really.
Yeah, for sure.
So where did it start?
I do too. I'll go back to the very beginning where it started where, you know, I was at that 14, 15, just getting into keyboard synthesizers and decided that I wanted to start making music.
Yeah.
And I was into like the alternative scene, the Depeche Mode, Soft Cell, Skinny Puppy, like all that shit. And all those groups heavily relied on synthesizers and drum machines. And that was like, that was my shit, you know? And so I started to learn to produce using that. Mm-hmm. But also during learning how to produce, I also learned how to record with real instruments too, with guitars. I have friends that play guitars, I have friends that play drums. I had a band actually in high school, I forgot. I had a band.
What was it called?
I was a keyboard player, A Portrait of Radical People.
Please bring that back. Please bring it back.
Yeah. I was a keyboard player. My friend Miles was a keyboard player, and my other friend Kelsey was a drummer and vocalist.
Okay.
And we made songs and did that for a few years. So during those few years, like, I really got good at producing. Not extremely good, just basically good. You know, knew how to, you can put me in the studio by myself and I can come out with a song.
Yeah.
And back then there was no laptops.
Yeah.
You know, there was no, so it was straight up MIDI gear wiring and
what
recording.
Were you
and
what were you sequencing on?
A Yamaha QX7.
Okay.
It was like $100 sequencer, but it was pretty dope though.
Yeah.
At some point, I met Terrence Parker,
okay.
Lou Robinson.
Yeah.
And we met through a mutual friend, and they saw that I'd made music.
Mm.
And they made music too. They were DJs and you know, were into like dance music. I wasn't into dance music yet.
Yeah.
But they knew they saw that I knew how to make music.
So what were you, in the band, what were you making? What type of music?
Like alternative.
Yeah.
Electronic sounding, you know.
Pop kind of vibe.
Not even pop. It was, okay. It was just alternative.
Okay.
More the Depeche Mode-ish, yeah. I guess. What wasn't radio at all, actually. exact opposite. So anyway, Terrence and Lou were like, yo, let's make a house song together.
Yeah.
I wasn't too familiar with it at the time. So they played me a couple things and I'm like, okay, that's easy. You know, I'm like, the drum beat is like just four on the floor.
Yeah.
Open hi-hat and clap.
Yeah.
Sterile. And we just kind of went from there. And I did the track with them. Ended up putting it out through a label called Byright. I know the record store was Byright. But the guy's name was Cliff.
Was this still in Detroit?
Still Detroit.
Yeah. And what was the record called?
The record was called First Base.
Okay.
And the group was called Separate Minds.
Okay.
And it was all three of us. And it was like a four-track EP.
Yeah.
And the song First Base ended up kind of taking off in like a techno world.
Okay.
And Kevin Saunderson heard it.
Mm.
And I didn't know Kevin at the time. I knew who he was because of Inner City.
Yeah.
Because I think Big Fun was popping at the time. And so Kevin licensed a song for his a compilation album.
Yeah.
So I think it was Detroit Techno was the album. And First Base was on it. And then from that point, I started getting into that type of music more. I'm like, oh, this is actually kind of dope.
Yeah.
And Juan Atkins was doing really well with Cybertron. All that kind of stuff. He was like the king of Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, during that era.
Stennis.
Jeff Mills was like, Jeff Mills was like, you know, on the radio, and everyone in Detroit knew who Jeff Mills was.
Yeah.
And then Shay Damier mm-hmm. called me. He was Kevin's A&R at KMS Records. So he called me. He's like, hey, you know, come in. Kevin wants to meet you. So I'm like, I think I was probably 17 at the time, 17, 18. So I go in and talk to Kevin, and Kevin's just like, hey, you know, like, I like what you do. Let's do something, mm-hmm. you know, let's put music out, whatever. And And I wasn't in it for the money.
Yeah.
Didn't care about the money. I just wanted to make music. And so I started doing songs with him. And I did my first 12-inch with Kevin. A track was called Somebody New. Mm. And on the other side was a song called The Rains.
Was that under that MK?
It was either MK or Mark Kinchin.
Okay.
It might have been MK. And the reason I use MK is just because I never cared about names.
Yeah.
Like artist names. I'm like, you know, I don't spend 3 hours like, let me get the perfect name for my, you know, song. I just call it what, you know, what I sample. Okay, call it that.
Yeah.
And I use MK. That's my initials.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I would go to Kevin's studio like on the weekends and just stay there. And Kevin would just give me a key and just like, hey, do your thing. And then I made Burning.
Yeah.
I made Burning in Kevin's studio. And the thing is I was trying to be different because Derek May was around, Juan Ackerman was around, Eddie Folks was around, Carl Craig was around, Kevin was around, of course. And then Kevin was doing inner city stuff. Derek was doing his stuff. And everyone kind of had the same, not formula. So I looked for a piece of gear in Kevin's studio where it wasn't a techno sound.
Mm.
And that's when I found the Vibe sound for Burning. Yeah. I'm like, this sounds cool because it just sounds dry. It sounds a little bit cheesy.
Yeah.
And so I just played those chords. And I'm like, I like this. And I put a drum beat to it and spent 6 months trying to get it written to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then I met Elena Simon through a mutual friend. And she was like, I sing. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like, let's go in the studio. And I just played it. And she just kind of wrote that. It wasn't like she wasn't sitting down for hours writing. She just kind of,
vibes.
You know, burning.
Yeah.
Or, and like, I'm like, that's perfect. It's like not too much. It's kind of, it's dark. It's kind of, you know, a little bit, you know. And we just went for it.
Wow.
And then, but from there. For some reason, well, not for some reason, I'm sounding like I'm arrogant, but no one liked it. You know, they're all going to say, you know, Kevin, they're all going to be like, no, we didn't. No one liked it, right? Because I sat on it for like 6 months and I'm like, but I love it. I think this is dope.
Yeah.
And all that time working with Kevin, I saw how Kevin put out records independently.
Yeah.
I saw how they would go through a distributor, go to record stores, sell the records, and I kind of copied that format.
Mm.
And that, but at the time, I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
So I had a cassette of Burning, and I knew who all the distributors were. There was only like three main ones.
Yeah.
I sent three cassettes to each distributor and said, hey, do you guys want to buy any of these? You know, this is my label. The label's called Area 10.
Yeah.
My song called Burning. They all called back like, oh yeah, we like this. Can we buy 1,000 copies? So each one, I don't remember the number, but each distributor bought like 1,000 copies.
Mm.
You know, I'm what, 19?
Yeah.
I don't have any money.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, can you guys do like COD?
Yeah.
Like basically, you know, means I'll get the records pressed. They send them to you. You guys pay the COD.
Yeah.
And that money went to the pressing plant.
Mm-hmm.
Because I decided to have money to press 1,000 copies.
Yeah, yeah.
So the distributors and the pressing plant worked hand in hand, and they got, so they all got their money. And I sold each vinyl for $2.30.
Bargain.
The vinyl cost $1 to make.
Yeah.
So I made a profit of $1.30, you know.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then long story short on that song, it ended up selling 20,000 copies because they kept coming back every weekend. Because, you know, back then it's like, DJs, they go vinyl shopping on Friday.
Yeah.
They play on the weekend. Then they come back to the shop Monday, like, yo, that track, I need that. Or people walk in, like, I need that song Burning.
Yeah.
And so the distributors will call and order more. So that was a cycle that went on for like about a year. And from then, that's when kind of stuff started kind of picking up after that.
Where did the whole Area 10 come from?
I worked in a parking lot at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit.
Wow.
I worked in the weekends. And each lot had a name.
Yeah.
My lot was called Area 10. So I just took it. Like, again, I didn't spend hours thinking of names. I just thought, like, that's a cool name. I'll use it. Like,
yeah. That's crazy.
just kind of ran with it.
And then after Burning, you weren't DJing at all then?
Not at all.
You weren't interested in it at all?
It's weird because I had decks. I had vinyl. Mm-hmm. Kevin Saunderson had decks set up in his studio. Like, when I went to the studio before, I would just hang out there and just play vinyl.
Yeah.
Just fucking around.
Yeah.
But I'd be playing vinyl for 15 minutes and then I'd have the itch to go make a track. Mm. The vinyl couldn't keep me away from the studio.
Yeah.
It just made me want to go make music. And that's where my passion was. So I didn't try to pursue DJing.
Yeah.
I was happy with just making music.
And back then, was you could make money making music, right?
I mean, doing it independently, and you know, didn't have a lot of expenses.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're making, and I was still paper chasing, I guess, I'm thinking. Mm. What did I get? Then Kevin Saunderson hired me for a few remixes.
Okay.
I did a remix. I did one for him. No one knows the story, but I did. He was having me do a remix for Reese Project.
Yeah.
One of his other groups he had. I started the remix and I'm like, oh, this is really dope.
Mm.
And Kevin wasn't in the studio at the time. He was like somewhere, but I was in his studio working on the remix. He didn't even know I was working on it that particular day. I ended up keeping the song. And that song is called For You.
Okay.
That's Fourth Measurement.
Yeah, yeah.
For You. And that was actually a Reese Project remix. Is that little sample For You?
Oh, really?
That's from Rachel, the vocalist from Reese Project.
Wow. Yeah.
So I ended up keeping that and doing another remix for him. But, you know, Kevin would pay me, like, you know, whatever the going rate was at the time. I don't know, $1,000 or something like that.
Yeah,
which is fine. And then ended up moving to New York. And that's when I met, you know, Marcy.
Yeah.
And she started managing me. And then that's when remixes started coming in heavy. And then that big one was Push the Feeling On that came in.
Yeah.
So
did that come out as an MK remix?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like the original song. I can finally talk about this because I've been wanting to talk about this song forever. The original is an R&B song.
Yeah.
Because at the time, Brand New Heavies were in.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, that was like a big group. And Nightcrawlers, they were like a Brand New Heavies type of group.
Okay.
And I think it was Darkest at Island. I forgot who hired me for that remix. I got hired to do the remix.
Yeah.
Did the remix. They didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
They came back and said, nah, it's not right. And I got like $5,000 for that mix. They got $5,000 for it. That's the most. I'm like, $5,000 for
a remix? That's crazy. Especially then.
A lot of money. Yeah. Yeah. And Marcy calls me. She's like, oh, they don't like the remix. I'm like, I have to go to Detroit. I have a flight tonight. I can't, nothing I can do now. And she's like, well, if you want to get paid, you kind of have to do something. And so that's when I did the Double Doom remix.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was using JBL speakers. One was blown. true story. One was blown. I was sitting on the floor. I had my mixer, one speaker. I had my Yamaha TX-81Z. I had my Akai S1100 sampler, my Roland R8 drum machine. Mm. I don't think I had a 909 then, and maybe a Juno 106. And I just, everything. So I started working on the remix and I was in such a hurry. Usually I spend a lot of time on my bass lines, on my yeah. lead lines, my samples. Everything was one take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, oh yeah, I like that. Cool. Record it. You know, yeah. I like that. Record it. Did it. True story, dude. Like, knocked the mix out maybe in an hour.
Yeah.
And recorded on DAT. I think, and here's the part that's crazy. Back then, I would just do the remix for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Like a 10-minute long edit. And then edit it later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On 2-inch tape or whatever. So I did the mix. Maybe I didn't do that one for that song. Whatever happened, I turned the mix in.
Mm-hmm.
Had a messenger come pick it up. Went to the airport. Went back to New York 2 weeks later and listened to the mix. And I was like, this is fire. Like, I'm like, this is fucking sick. And I called my brother, Scott Kinchin, Scotty Deep. I called him. I'm like, listen to this. He's like, what the fuck is that? I'm like, dude, it's a remix I did like 2 weeks ago. He's like, that's bananas. I'm like, I know. And then from that point, it just kind of took off.
Yeah.
The crazy part is I didn't DJ back then.
Mm.
So I never really knew what it was doing. Only kind of from what my friends would tell me, or if I was in New York at a club and heard it.
Yeah.
But I didn't go out that much either. So I didn't really know what it was doing, but I knew it was doing well. You know, I found out how well it's done like years later, obviously.
Yeah.
So that was the one. And the weird part, the reason I said this story is crazy is because the original version was an R&B song.
Yeah.
My version, which I didn't even use any of the original. I'd use some of John's vocals. But because it was a remix, so some people don't know this, but unless you ask for it, you don't own any of it.
Yeah.
You don't own any publishing. The original writers own it. So anytime, you know, you hear that Nightcrawler sample, that dun, 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 or the anything from it, I don't get paid from it. And it sold millions and millions of copies. Millions of copies.
Did that come out as, did they eventually release it as a single?
Yeah. They buried the original version.
Yeah, you that's what I was saying. Yeah. Version. I've never even heard of the original.
Yeah, I mean, it's you have to kind of dig. If you dig hard enough, you can find it on YouTube, maybe.
Yeah.
But they buried it. You can't get it at all.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I take it you don't speak to them anymore.
No, I mean, it's I still speak to John Reed a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's all weird because it's four members of the group,
yeah.
And for me to get any type of publishing, they have to
all agree to it.
All agree,
yeah.
All agree. But the weird thing is, like, you know, there was never any contract signed, and it's like, what's the rule on that, really?
Mm.
You know, because I am the writer on it, but you know, no one's. It's so unclear.
There's always so many different rules and laws and stuff, and you're just like. I think that's the thing with clearing samples and everything like that as well. And just generally music is like, well, it wasn't, who was it? Wasn't it Pharrell and Robert Thicke?
Yeah. They, yeah. But Blurred Lines. Yeah.
Yeah. They got sued millions for like,
yeah,
the feel of, yeah, of like a Marvin Gaye record. It wasn't,
it
wasn't even the court.
It was a lot of money.
It was like,
it was a lot of money.
Yeah. I think it was like tens of millions.
Yeah. I want to say 20 million.
Yeah.
Could be wrong, but I want to say it was a lot. It was a ridiculous amount. And then let me just finish this Nightcrawler and go on to something else. But years later, Pitbull sampled it for a song, Hotel Room. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing house music at the time. I was kind of just, you know, just producing, trying to, you know, make my way in the industry again.
Yeah.
And my brother calls me, Scott. He's like, why don't you call Pitbull? Like, obviously he likes your shit.
Yeah.
You know, call him and maybe just see if you can do some tracks with him. Called him, got in touch with his people. Hey, Pitbull, MK wants to work with you. He was like, hell no. Right? So I'm like, but this Pitbull, or this guy Buddha who worked with Pit, was basically like, well, why?
Yeah.
He said, because he charged me 90% to use that sample for a Hotel Room. And then they told Pitbull, like, no, MK doesn't own any of that. He didn't, he basically got fucked on it too.
Damn.
Like, he gets no part of that. And so Pitbull was like, bring him in. And so Pitbull from that point, like, took me under his wing. Like, he fucking helped me out.
Jesus.
He's like,
man.
Yo, he was like, MK, I got you. Just, you know, come work with me.
I knew Pitbull sampled it, but I didn't know they did him over like that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Crazy, like, you know.
And then also now that record's kind of come back.
Yeah.
Like with the
with the Friday thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't get any of that as well.
Well, it's weird because Mustafa, the guy who danced in the car, we spoke after that happened. We're like, oh, this is crazy. And we said, let's remake it.
Yeah.
That was my idea, basically.
Yeah.
So we're like, yeah, let's cool. Let's do it. And I had them go in the studio and re-record the, what day is it? You know, the whole talking part.
Yeah.
So they went in the studio, I think it was DC, to record it. And at some point, it got just, I don't know if Ministry Sounds went after him to do it instead. And then Nightcrawlers got involved. The four guys got involved. And then Ministry wanted me to produce it.
Yeah.
I think before Reton. Something like that. I don't know exactly what happened, but it was between all of us getting ready to work on it. So I'm thinking like, cool, I can finally get publishing from it. Like I can finally get a percentage. And they still said no.
Oh my God. So did you end up doing it?
So I'm like, no, I didn't do it. I'm like, I'm not going to fuck myself again.
No.
Like, I'm just not going to do it. It's like, you know.
That's so wild, man. Because I knew there was history behind it all. But we haven't spoke about that before. I didn't. Motherfuckers. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm like, you know.
Well, and I think it's also, at the end of the day, it's more so just principle in the grand scheme of it.
That's what everyone, like, yeah, it's like, you know, it's just, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no need to just, and even when I did, I wasn't even asked for, I think I was asked for 20%.
Mm.
If I produced a new one.
Yeah.
And if it's four of them, I'm like, that's only 5% of each of your guys' share.
Yeah. And it's paid for their life, for their whole lives. They've not done anything since.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that song's made enough money, too, where, you know.
Yeah. Damn, dude. Good job you've got some other hits.
Yeah. I mean, I'm dying right now.
I want to go back. So when did Always happen?
Always happened right after Burning.
And was that in Detroit?
Yeah, Detroit the same way. But the thing with Always was weird is I know I wanted to use Elena. Mm. But I made the track and I actually wrote the lyrics. I wrote the whole song for Always. I mean, she came in with the Always hook part, but we just basically got that from Stevie Wonder. Mm. So yeah, that was just one we did, and we just. And back then, it's like, I never really put too much thought into what I'm putting out. Because it was just me as an artist. It's just, you know, if this is what I made, generally because I wanted to make it, I'm putting it out. You know, nowadays, you know, there's so many zillions of people that have to listen to it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, love it. But back then, it was like, I made it, like it, put it out.
Just a vibe.
Yeah. Just a vibe.
So we go from Pitbull, working with Pitbull, how was that?
It was fun, but it's still, you know, it's working in that pop world.
Yeah.
There's so many people involved. Mm. And plus with Pit always knew what he wanted. So he would have a lot of input.
Yeah.
Then, you know, the label would have input. Like one example is I did the opening song for Men in Black 3, Pitbull.
Yeah.
And I think I went through like maybe 30 versions from down to like the film director having comments.
Yeah.
The head of Sony having a comment, you know, I'm like, why do I have comments? You know, like it's just the intro for the movie. Like, so, and I don't like that.
No.
Basically. It's like this, that's not, well, it's not funny anymore.
Well, it tears, like, you have a baby, right? And then it's everyone wants a piece of it, and everyone wants to kind of say. And I think a lot of the time with A&Rs and labels and managers and agents and all of that, it comes to the point where it's not actually, they don't actually know what they're saying. They just want to say something.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. They're saying something because they feel like they have to say something.
Yeah.
Play you a song. Okay. All right. Change that though.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Turn this one down, turn this one up, and you don't do anything and send it back.
Yeah, there'll be jokes. You know, I remember being in the studio with producers and we'd have jokes like when the A&R comes in saying, hey, turn that hi-hat up. And you're like, How's that? And it's not even a hi-hat track. Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah. It's a lot better. But yeah, I thought so.
It's the best, that, isn't it?
There's a lot of that going on. It just, that wasn't fun, and that's why, you know, getting back into house music this way is like a lot better.
What went from?
Because I have a lot more.
Go on.
No, I just said I have a lot more control now. Like, yeah. I don't really have to deal with as much at all.
From Pitbull, where do we go then? Because I know there's still a lot in between before you get to where you're at.
After Pitbull was, that's when I met Jamie Jones and Lee Foss.
Mm.
And during that time, it was like 2012, 11.
Yeah.
And that's when like just the whole Detroit sound was coming back in heavy.
Yeah.
The deep house, just the slower house stuff. And they were playing a lot of my music.
Mm.
And they never really knew that I didn't DJ at the time.
Yeah.
But they asked me to DJ their party.
Okay. Was this in, in Ibiza?
No, this was in Miami.
Okay.
And I was like, man, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
Like, let's just do it. Like, I mean, I'll just end up playing a lot of my songs anyway. I know how my songs start, finish. So how hard could it be?
Yeah.
And I went from there, but I played a lot of my own stuff. Where it was actually, you know, it's very easy to, as you would know, to play your own songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, you can just hear that you know if you're not doing something right because you know both songs. So
yeah,
it was doing that. And then Simon Dunmore reached out at the same time, and Simon Dunmore wanted to do something with Burning, with my back catalog.
Yeah.
Which is kind of perfect timing. And then from that, Simon, you know, ended up putting me on a lot of shows, Defected shows. I was never signed to Defected, but he made sure that, you know, I got the exposure.
Yeah.
And from that point, within there, that's when I did Storm Queen Look Right Through. Because he asked me to do a remix for him, and I, you know, ended up doing that one. And that one did really well.
That was, and then that, for me, the Storm Queen was like the point. What year was that? 2008? 2008?
13. No, 13.
13.
13.
That,
yeah. That's what that's for, that. At number one, that's like, that's Storm Queen.
I was going to say, that was the one that in the UK kind of...
It went number one, yeah.
It went mental. Yeah. It went absolutely mental. Yeah.
And the good thing about that one, it was... The good thing about that remix, it was like, that was just my sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, had the organ. Didn't have piano in it though, but had organ, had the vocal chops. And it was just... So which kind of made it easy to kind of stay in that genre, that lane of,
yeah,
because, you know, sometimes you may do something and look up on a song, it's like, that's not my sound, but I just got a hit from it, and then it's hard to follow up.
Yeah totally.
But luckily that one was like, you know, right where I sat.
And then after that was My Head Jungle. After that,
yeah, My Head is a Jungle,
that was a big one.
Yeah, that was, yeah, and again, that was, it was a big one, but it was like a sleeper. It went like number 5 in the charts, I think.
Yeah.
But it's weird because people, you know, I still play it, obviously. Yeah, it was a big one. And then from that, then the record deal. And then I started just DJing a lot overseas in England, and just, you know, ended up doing really well with just shows.
Yeah.
Then got a record deal with Sony. And then from then, put out, we just started to get the singles ready. And it was like, I never really wanted to do a record deal.
Yeah.
Start with that, because I knew working with Pitbull, and back then I'm like, I'm gonna have people tell me what to do again. Like, I don't want to do that, man. Like, I just want to make a song and put it out.
Yeah.
So my first couple releases were kind of like, weren't my favorite. Bring Me to Life. What was after that? And that was me just kind of getting in the groove of working with a record company.
Yeah.
But I think once 17 happened, that's when I kind of got back into like, okay, this is, I'm not really telling people what's going on.
Yeah.
Piece of Me and 17. With Piece of Me, I did. And Sony were like, yeah, it's all right. I'm like, no, it's this is dope. And I remember like taking, because I would play it in shows and people would DM me. And I had a whole folder of people like DM me, like, what is the song? What is the song?
Mm.
And I had to get it sent to Sony. Like, this song needs to come out.
Yeah.
And it finally came out. And then same thing with 17. Like, I did 17, played it for like 6 months, and no one at the label was like jumping up and down, but I saw the reaction when I played it and they weren't there. So I'm like, oh, this is it. I'm telling you guys.
It's,
like,
it's the best thing about being able to DJ, right? Is that you can, test your music out, and you know that, like, I don't know, I'm sure you've had this, I have this multiple times, where you write a record in the studio and you're like, this is a banger. Like, this is amazing. Yeah, and then you go play it out and it doesn't hit. And like, no one gives a fuck about it. And you're like, what? Like, I'm so wrong. And then you make something and you're like, okay, this is all right. I play it. And you play it out and it slams. And you're like, I was not expecting that.
But you know what I've noticed most of the time when that happens? Because I've thought about that exact thing you're saying. Yeah. I go back and it's usually the mix.
Yeah. Okay.
It's usually the levels or just something not sitting right. Or the way you played it. It's usually something like that.
Yeah.
Because usually in your gut feeling, you know you have something. Yeah. You know you have it.
Yeah. Or sometimes when you have the right vocal or something and you just have to just go in and rewrite the record again because it's just not fitting right with the vocal or something like that. That happens so many times to me. And I'm like, this vocal's so good, but I just haven't got the music right.
I know. I'm the opposite. Because if that happens to me, it's like, I'm done with it.
Yeah.
I'm like, I won't touch it again. I'm like, oh, didn't work. I'm not going to even try.
Oh, really? Can you not go back?
Yeah. Mm-mm. Nope.
Just bin it. Bin it off.
Yeah. Just bin it.
Bin it. Do you ever ask people for like help on that?
Only engineers.
Yeah.
Only ask engineers. I don't really ask other producers. I may ask other musicians.
Yeah.
I may say, hey, listen, my chords just aren't right.
Yeah.
Can you help me out with some chords here?
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. So. It's definitely for me, like I've just finished my last single of the year. And I just sent it to a mate and there was just like a few tweaks that just made it so much better.
Put it on the top.
And you're just like, wow, that was good. So.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When, because you kind of got really big in the UK and Europe, mid-2000s, and then when we were under the same management, that was when you kind of started to come back to America and started touring America. From back when you started writing music to now, how different is the scene compared to?
Oh, it's night and day. It's like, I mean, for back in, you know, when I started doing house music back then, it was gay and black. That was the scene. Like the clubs were like gay, black, Hispanic, not many white people.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, New York, because New York has all the cool white people. So, but for the most part, it was just gay and black.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about that is, jumping stories for a second, but when I moved to New York, I stopped doing house music to do R&B and hip hop. And I didn't even tell people that I used to do house music, even though I had night crawls under my belt, even though I had burning under my belt. I did not mention that because I knew I didn't get respected in the industry.
Would they think you're gay?
No, I don't think I'm gay. They just think like it's not cool.
Yeah.
Like that music is like, it doesn't, it's such a small market compared to R&B and hip hop. Mm. Like, you know, we don't care about making, you know, selling 20,000 records.
Yeah.
You know,
we want a million.
We want to sell, you know, a minimum of a million.
Yeah.
So it was just not respect. You cannot get anywhere with that on your resume.
Yeah. Now it's completely different.
which I'm really glad is completely different. And I, you know, I love hip hop and R&B, but it's like, it's finally switched. And it's like, I don't feel sorry for people in that other world.
Yeah.
Cause I've been there and it's like, dude, it's like, I've had to live with it for, you know, 15 years of house music and not being shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
So sorry.
What?
Sorry.
Why the move to New York to do hip hop and R&B? What was that about?
Well, I moved to New York to do house music.
Yeah.
Because I just, you know, at the time Detroit just started getting like, that's when it was getting like heavy techno.
Yeah.
Underground Resistance stepped in, they were doing their thing. And just my sound was like, this isn't fitting in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like everything else. It's like, you know, I like vocals. I like, you know, a little bit cooler shit, like vibey, you know, deep house type vibes. And New York and Chicago had that.
Yeah.
Especially New York and like, you know, Mass at Work were my favorite producers.
Yeah.
And they that sound was exactly what I wanted to do. Mm. I'm like, I'm out. I'm going to New York. I'm gonna get some of that vibe. So.
And then you just decided to go into hip hop and R&B.
Yeah. Well, it started to get boring.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with my manager, it was like the remixes requests were coming in heavy.
Yeah.
And it started to get like a machine. Mm-hmm. And the fun part about it started to go away.
Yeah.
The money was good, but I'm like, yeah, this isn't fun. And I'm like, mm-hmm. And knowing at the time, you know, I didn't know how long I'd be in the industry. I didn't think I'd be in the industry this long. So I'm like, I'm getting remixes, I'm getting fees for remixes, you know, 10, 15 grand a remix. But you know, I'll spend that and within that year.
Yeah.
You know, so what am I gonna do when I'm 30?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't think I'm gonna be remixed when I'm 30. That's what I actually thought. So I said, you know, I've always been kind of writing songs and writing hip hop and R&B on the low. Mm. I'm like, let me just do that, because that way at least I can write a song and possibly, you know, have royalties coming in and have stuff that comes in when I'm older. So I quit doing house music. And on top of that, everyone wanted something to sound like, everyone wanted a remix to sound like Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
Because that was my best remix. So I'm like, this is really not it. And so I stopped.
Mm. Were you writing originals at that time as well? Or were you just like strictly remix?
What, for R&B?
No, like when you were doing when you're doing remixes, because
I was still doing both. I would still have my MK deal.
Yeah.
But the remixes came in so often. Like I was doing like, God, how many? I feel like I was doing like at least 10 remixes a month.
Damn.
Yeah. Like it was crazy.
Yeah.
But it was, like I said, it was quick money. There'd be no royalties. So I'm like, let me not be stupid here. Mm. And it's not like I put money away to save, you know, 25. I'm just like, you know, blowing it, buying equipment.
Yeah.
And so then I started to do R&B and hip hop. And then that whole industry is totally different from any other industry, because, you know, you're dealing with like a little bit of crookedness.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of hey, I can get you on this album, but you know, you got to give me half your fee.
Yeah.
Or you got to give my boy some of your publishing.
Yeah.
And you know, it was like a lot of that. And I'm like, oh man, this is whack too.
Even worse.
Yeah, this is, you know, or you're chasing a project. And then at one point I worked with Quincy Jones. I was signed to his publishing company, and you know, a guy named Jay Brown managed me at the time. And Jay Brown, who's like Jay-Z's best friend right now, and partner in business. I was in the studio with everyone, R&B artists. Like I was doing songs with everybody.
Yeah.
And it was before the internet, it was before Napster, right?
Yeah.
So the music industry was still, you know, just raining in money.
Yeah.
So I remember one year I made 300 grand in fees from songs that never made the album.
Oh, wow.
That's how much money was just being thrown around.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is awesome. You know, like I have all these songs that are ready to be sold. I made a lot of money. And then 2000, Napster just kind of just killed the industry.
Yeah.
Just like that. And labels weren't spending money anymore like that. So now it's like, hey, if you want to, you know, get a song on Destiny's Child album, submit a song. If we use it, you'll get paid.
Yeah.
But before that, you would get paid before you even, you know,
really
do anything with it. Yeah. And so now it's like all these producers are like, damn, we're chasing it. Now we're really chasing the check.
Yeah.
So it was a rat race.
Yeah, I bet.
Every producer that I knew, it was a rat race to get a placement. And then, you know,
that kind of takes a soul out of it as well, doesn't it? Because you just
it takes a soul out of it.
Everyone's fighting. But
everyone's still, you know, you have to compete with Timberland, Pharrell,
yeah,
all those guys, because they were getting placements easily.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were getting 150 grand a track.
Yeah.
All day long.
It's mental how different, and it still is now, how hip hop and R&B is on compared to dance music. Because like, even in dance music, you get occasionally one record that like gets licensed for like 150 grand, 170 grand.
Whatever. Right.
Like we all know those. Right. And the only reason why we know those is because everyone's like, how the fuck did they get that? And the whole industry talks about it. But that happens twice a year.
One song a year. Yeah. One or two songs a year.
Yeah. And no one knows what it's going to be. It's literally just a luck of the draw, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas
absolutely
in hip hop is every fucking week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. So I was doing that. And then I got to the point where, you know, I moved to LA, and that's when I met Will Smith. Mm. And because I was going a period of my life, I was making songs, having writers come to my studio, you know, like we're trying to make a song for Usher.
Yeah.
Got a session, 2-day session. No, it's not right. Spent a month on a song, right? We're going to get this Usher. Get it to Usher. He doesn't take it.
Yeah.
So you just spend a month for nothing.
Yeah.
But then every once in a while, you get a song that gets placed. You make enough money that, so you work for 6 months, no placements, but then you finally get that placement at the last month. Covers all the bills that you've been late for.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that. That shit is whack too. I'm like, okay, this is terrible. Then I moved to LA, and I knew Will and Omar, and they brought me in as an in-house producer.
Yeah.
And kind of just to do the same thing I was doing, but also make songs, whatever Will's working on, whatever Will may need for a TV show, movie, whatever, I'd be there to work on that. Mm. And I got a fee. So I was still taken care of without really worrying about, what's good. You know, so I was cool money-wise. The problem was nothing was coming out.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, okay, now I'm back in here again. I'm like, I'm okay financially.
Yeah.
But there's no money. There's no songs coming in that's going to bring me royalties.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm going to be fucked. And then, you know, I started working with a writer named Diane Warren. Same thing. I ended up doing like a couple songs on Ariana Grande. Like,
oh, really?
I think 4 or 5 songs that never made the album. But, she came in. We recorded them together.
Yeah.
But then she changed directions on her album. So that was like almost 8 months of my time that just got wasted. And so right after then, that's when Pitbull sampled pushing on for Hotel Room. And so I got in there with Pit, and then Pitbull made sure I was financially okay. And I was doing songs that were coming out with Pitbull at least.
Yeah.
And that's, so then we get to Jamie and Simon Dunmore.
Mm.
And then I got into my own MK thing, and then the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. Mate, you've had a fucking interesting life.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I could definitely write a book.
You should definitely write a book.
I could definitely write a book, yeah. Yeah.
Is that something you'd want to do?
Yeah. Because each thing I talked about, there's obviously a deeper story to it.
Of course. Like,
and a more, there's a, it's very interesting.
Like, imagine,
it's very interesting.
Just, I can imagine just the Will Smith in-house producer stories. Right. Like, there's a lot of stories.
Yeah, stories with that. And then I ended up working, I did Jaden, his son's.
Yeah.
His first mixtape, I did like a couple songs on that.
Yeah.
I did a song with his daughter, Willow, and Nicki Minaj.
Mm.
I worked with his other son, Trey.
Yeah.
Because Will wanted me to just help him like get into producing and DJing. So I worked with all the kids. I worked with Jada too, his wife. Did songs with her. So, you know, there's a whole chapter in there.
Yeah, that's wild, man. Were you still doing hip hop and R&B when Jamie and Lee hit you up, or had you kind of
getting
that off?
I'm like, the way he just got rid of my, you know, on my hard drive with the hip hop sample. Like, nah, I go over there, I'm done. Like, I'm done. Let's get my house kit back.
Yeah. Let's get the 909 and 808 out.
Did
it? How was that financially though? Because
which one?
From
Will?
No, from the transition between Will to Jamie Jones to when you started DJing, really. Because,
well,
also,
my overhead was so low.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I was married, had kids, live in the condo in LA.
Mm.
Our rent was like, you know, $1,500 a month.
Okay,
so you know my overhead was just crazy low. So
yeah.
when I did a show and got paid $1,500 to DJ, I'm like, this is right. Crazy. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, you do four of those a month, like that's a decent salary.
Yeah. It is.
So I was good. And then, you know, it just kind of grew from there. But, and then, you know, it was just easier on my mind. It was like, you know, you can finally just breathe. And like, you know, I knew I was kind of controlling my own destiny at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I'm DJing now. And I always knew from even back in the 90s, if I DJed and made music, that they would be a lot better.
Yeah.
Because I can make a song, test it out. Mm. Or I would just be in clubs all the day, all the time. And know what people really like.
Yeah.
Instead of sitting in my bedroom and guessing and just hearing mix shows on the radio, because that's what I did back then. Just kind of like, you know, guessing.
Winging it, yeah.
But I always knew DJing would help my music.
It's
what it does.
It has. Oh, massively. And it's still the case now whereas you still kind of have to, you make more money DJing than you do with music.
Yeah, right.
Which it has been for years, but it's definitely the case.
Yeah, for sure.
When was it for you when you started DJing when you were like, damn, I'm pretty big. I'm doing all right.
Weirdly, right away.
Yeah.
And I don't mean sound like, you know, shit those things, but it happened right away.
Yeah.
Because of what I did in the 90s.
Yeah.
And because, you know, most of the things I played, people knew almost every song I played that was mine. And it was like, you know, my third show DJing.
Yeah.
And those shows kind of sold out pretty much right away.
Wow.
So when Dunmore started putting me on shows, they did really, really well straight out the gate. Like, so I never really experienced playing to like a half full club or, you know, not even in my early career.
Jesus.
Yeah.
There's not many people that can say that.
Yeah.
At all. Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. It's been like.
But you must have, you must have kind of experienced, I don't think I've spoke to you about this before, but there's your crowd because of your music now is a younger crowd, which is really kind of important in this industry because.
It's weird. It's like. It's like, I'm like, how did it just stays the same?
Yeah.
I'm like, how is it only 18-year-olds at the show every year?
Yeah, they don't get older. But it's, I think that's the kind of a special thing about playing, about your music is that it just keeps the crowd so young. But when you first started DJing again, the crowd must have been old.
Yeah, it was. It was actually. It was older. But because it was definitely a cooler scene back then, especially with Jamie and Lee.
Yeah.
So there was definitely a cool crowd. So you had the older people, but you still had the 20-year-olds. But that was like, you know, there's that group of cool 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
In every pocket, every city.
Yeah.
Just with any type of music, there's like that, you know, the cool, whether it's hip hop or, you know, there's that cool 20-year-old crowd. And so that crowd was there.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
they're kind of the crate diggers, aren't they? That that don't DJ or don't do anything. They just love listening.
Yeah.
The crazy thing with your fans is that they are literally just there to see you, and it's absolutely mental. I've like never experienced it playing any other show, and this is all kind of. Hands up to you really on kind of what you've done is that
right.
You can play an MK show and no one give a fuck who you are until MK comes on. And
yeah, then, it's a little weird, but yeah, I know you know. Yeah, because
but it's, I don't think there's anybody else out there that's done that.
Really? I mean,
I think there is artists that probably have that are like Chemical Brothers and stuff like that.
Right.
Disclosure, right. And people like that.
Right.
But yeah. For somebody that is a DJ, that's DJing shows, like none of those artists that are kind of like the Chems, they're all doing live stuff. So on warm-ups, it's just the DJ sat at the front and everyone's just kind of coming into the stadium. And it is. When was it Storm Queen that kind of that was it?
No, it wasn't. It's weird. It's kind of in the beginning. It's like, you know, I would walk through the crowd and people were like, can I have a picture? I'm like, what? It was a lot of that from the beginning. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just kind of like, it's just, you know, someone sees someone with an MK picture. I'm like, oh, I want to get one. Honestly, I don't know what it is. But I'm not complaining. I don't want to rock the boat. So I'm
like, dude, it's amazing. It's like, you don't see it often at all. And I think because you're fucking tall and very recognizable.
Yeah, I think
that does always help as well.
I think that.
What was that?
Well, you know what? In the beginning, I did do this. I did would go to shows. And I would hang out in the crowd before I play. And I remember a lot of people saying, like, no one ever does that. Like, that's something cool. Like, you know, I'm like, I'll just be at the bar, just like, you know, having a drink.
Yeah.
Me and Davenport, he would stand with me and we would watch people walk by. And we would just watch their reaction because they would walk by, like, was that it? And it was fun, you know. And so I don't know, but I did that a lot.
And then it got a bit mental, so you couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, I still try to do it at festivals sometimes, but you know, it gets a little difficult.
Yeah. What was that? What was that Snapchat that went around years ago when somebody took a picture?
Jenny fucking Jones. Yeah, I was in Ireland. I forgot what festival it was, but Jamie had played the night before me. Because I literally saw, when I landed, I saw Jamie at the airport.
Yeah.
Yo, what's up? See you later. How was the show? It was good. Okay, I'm going to go play it now.
Yeah.
Get to the show and I'm walking through the crowd. And some girl says, oh my God, there's Jamie Jones. And they run over and take a picture. And then she posted it. She said, you know, she wrote Jamie fucking Jones. And it was like, it spread like wildfire. It was crazy.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a special time, definitely.
Yeah, it was like, and it's funny because like it happened after my show. Or no, it happened before the show. So I played the show and left. Get on the plane. And by this time, the picture's starting to circulate. I'm on the plane. I land. I feel like almost every DJ I know sent me a picture like, what the fuck? Ah. It was, you know, it's like everyone thought it was hilarious. I'm like,
did you post it?
I didn't actually think it was that funny, but I'm like, huh?
Did you post it?
Yeah, I reposted it. Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, I guess, yeah. I remember when that happened. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
How has it been coming back playing shows since COVID and all that shit?
Oh, it's been good. I mean, I just did a Texas run this past weekend. It was amazing. Like,
yeah.
I played Steer Alive in Dallas, which is like a huge venue, and it was sold out.
It's a big venue, though.
And usually I would play a smaller club in Dallas, but it's like a huge venue sold out, you know, which is pretty good. So everything right now is excellent.
Sick.
No complaints.
Sick. What have you got coming out music-wise?
I'm doing, you know, because I've been talking about doing this album for years. And the reason why I haven't is because I really couldn't figure out what sound I wanted to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way it works, it's like, who buys albums now?
Yeah.
Because it was kind of in that turning point. I'm like, is someone really going to buy an MK album?
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't feel like they would buy an album. I feel like they would buy singles, you know, with Spotify and all the, you know, YouTube and all the streaming platforms. I'm like, people just, at least not dance music. Mm. You know, maybe a Drake album, yeah, but who's gonna buy an MK album?
Yeah.
So I never really felt pressured to do it. But now over the past couple months, I've decided to come out with a compilation, a collab album.
Okay.
A collab EP.
Yeah.
So it's like six people who each I'm doing a collab with.
Sick.
So, I did one with Burns.
He's great.
They've got Paul Wolfert.
Amazing.
I have Aluna.
Nice.
I have Weiss.
Sick.
And I think I'm talking to Dom about doing one. And a few more people that aren't really dance music.
Yeah.
We're just trying to get it together and just do something like that. You know, six songs. Bam.
Are they going to be like short songs or like proper?
No, like club songs. Club songs. Like club songs.
Amazing. Yeah. And you're going to put that out as like a project, or they're going to come out as individual?
Yeah, as a project.
Yeah, sick.
As a project. As a project. Just something different.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
That's cool. That's all I got for you.
Not giving us any secrets.
I mean, I'll give you something, but
there's nothing. Dude, we've just done an hour. It's been kind of, I think this is what everyone wanted to hear. So thanks for coming.
Finally got to say some things I wanted to say, so that's good.
Yeah, man, it's good. It's, you know, we don't get to talk like about our careers that often. Quite nice. We get to talk about it in like interviews, but it's always edited down and short-formed.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
hopefully people learn a lot and get to know a bit more about you.
And if anyone wants to help me write a book, hit me up.
I want you to write a book really badly.
Yeah, but how do you? I mean, like, you sit down and just like, okay.
My mum's just released a book. She's just published a book, and she's right. Wow. I think she's on her third book now writing.
Really?
And yeah, she just does like 30 minutes a day, hour a day.
Okay.
And just like
really
writes like bullet points and then what she wants to talk about, and then kind of goes.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Like, just have your like write all your chapters out on what you want to talk about,
right?
And then kind of split it down into like more micro.
That's a good idea. Yeah,
but you can also get somebody to write for you.
I'd assume that I would kind of tell my story, and then someone would kind of put it in book form.
Mm.
I don't know.
You have to
I
do.
Wrote a book before. I don't know how it goes.
You have to do an audiobook though, and you have to read it.
Oh, okay.
Because there's there's so many audiobooks out there where the author doesn't actually read it. I actually listened to the Will Smith one the other day.
Not yet. I heard it's really good though.
It's really good.
It's really good.
I
can imagine he talks about all the things that you would never imagine.
Yeah.
That have happened.
It's kind of like what we were just talking about. We don't get the chance to talk about it. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in the industry, a lot of stuff that goes on in our lives.
Yeah, they don't know about.
And it's realistically, nobody needs to know about it until the time's right to talk about it.
Exactly.
But I did the Dave Grohl one. That's really interesting.
Really?
Yeah, it's really good. Wow. It's called Storyteller.
Okay.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks when I'm traveling. Like gets me through flights.
Yeah, I hear you.
Quick one. This is just geeky talk. Have you heard the Apple Max AirPods? The headphones?
Mm. Yeah. I have them right there.
Oh, you motherfucker.
Hold on. Are you talking about these?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah,
I didn't even know Apple bought over here headphones apart from the Beats stuff.
Oh shit!
And then I was with Sheba the other day, and he put them on my head and was like, and I was mind blown.
Yeah,
they're amazing.
They have that thing where you can turn your head and it sounds follows your head. Did you see that?
Yeah, it's weird that.
I don't know what it's called, but yeah, it's a little weird. I don't know if
I don't know if I like that.
Yeah, I know.
It is a bit
weird. It's a little bit unnecessary.
Yeah, it's just like, I just want the sound to always be in my ears, not yeah. on the left side yeah. of my ear. But
yeah, yeah.
I think
yeah,
it's well, for their like,
cool, but yeah.
they do spatial yeah, audio.
The new audio thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. yeah
Have
yeah.
you done any records in that?
Not yet. Not yet. I mean, I want to.
I did my last single in it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. We got somebody to mix it down in spatial audio.
But you can do it in Logic though, right?
You can do, yeah. Yeah.
But you didn't try doing Logic?
I don't have spatial audio speakers.
Right.
So I think you need like, I don't know what speakers you need for spatial audio to mix it in.
Right. You probably just need 7, I think.
Yeah, 7.1.
Yeah.
I stick to my 2 at the moment.
Yeah, no doubt.
Right, 2, dude.
I'm good.
Thanks for coming on, man. See you very soon, I'm sure. Oh, I'll see you in Miami.
Me, Will. Oh, yeah. Bam, there it is.
Damn. Sick, man. Love you, dude.
All right, homie.
Keep safe.
Love you.
Bye, man.
Later.
And that is a wrap. Big love to everybody that listens. Thanks to MK for coming on. Please subscribe, share it, send it to your friends, tell everyone about it. Enjoy, subscribe. See you next time.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you're ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.